town, so I think we'll start with Jack Paulson. We'll take a little look at what we are doing in Centerfile 1 and the many mechanisms that are in this bill to offer property tax relief to Minnesotans. I think that this bill does cover a lot of the options that the Senate has and will be considering this year. So we'll take a run at that, but this is not an all-inclusive list by any means, and certainly look forward to what you have for ideas. Jack is going to walk us through the areas that deal with the homestead and ag value credit property tax refund. We're going to look at LGA and county program aid. And Jack, maybe when you're done, we would just have a couple minutes of discussion about the value caps, the limited market caps that are set to expire. And then when Mr. Nauman comes up, we're going to talk a little bit about the education relief that's in Centerfile 1, which is commonly referred to as the roll-in that we did a couple years ago. We've got the similar provisions. So with that, Mr. Paulson.
Mr. Chairman and members, Senate File 1, I'll be starting on page 3, Section 5. The first four sections of Senate File 1 are an adjustment to bring in the increasing the referendum allowance for schools. If you'd like, Mr. Chairman, perhaps Mr. Nauman could go through those.
How is your schedule, Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chairman, with apologies, my information was that you were beginning at 9 o'clock and Senator Stumpf was meeting with me, but my schedule is open for you now. So.
Why don't we let Mr. Nauman go, and then he can go finish up his meeting with Senator Stumpf. So, members, we're going to go back and revisit sections 1, 2, and 3, the education portion of Senate File 1. We are looking at the role of mechanism for property tax relief and also for reducing the disparities in education.
And, Mr. Chairman Nauman. And members, I put together some information that I believe is in your packet, and I'm not sure if you would like to go through that first or talk through the language, or it's really your pleasure how you'd like to do this.
Let's go through the information that you put in the packet, Mr. Nauman.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members, I'd like to start with these two charts here that refer to the 2001 education reform just sort of as a look back. And these are a segment of a larger briefing that we gave to the Education Finance Committee about 2 weeks ago. And its intent is to just take a look back at what we did in the 2001 reform with respect to education finance. And in 2001, members will probably recall the discussion about the big plan. This was a proposal that was ultimately adopted into law to eliminate the general education levy. That was a levy that was imposed on the entire general education program at about $1.3 billion. And after netting out credits and income taxes, the total cost to the state was $880 million. There were a few other education programs that got, in a sense, caught up in this reform proposal. Supplemental and transition revenue were two separate categorical programs that were rolled onto the referendum before we made what we called the 415 transfer at the time. That was to take $415 of referendum authority that was that existed on the referendum line, make a mechanical subtraction, and then add $415 to the formula allowance. So the formula allowance grew by $415, and any school district that had referendum of $415 or less had their referendum reduced to zero. Any amount that was any district that had referendum authority above 415 had their allowance reduced by $415. And so, Mr. Chairman, I think it's potentially useful to take a look at some of those pie charts that we show at the bottom And I want to stress this is just the general education program and the referendum revenue by source. So property taxes prior to the 03 buyout, which is the year that it became effective, were about 33%, and the state aid was 67%, and it dropped down to 96 and 4. So in a sense, the immediate impact was fairly clear. That's what members thought they were achieving. Then over time, policy choices as well as property valuation changes in the K-12 formulas have begun to eat away at some of that reform, and we're now back at about 11% property tax as of the most recent forecast for fiscal year 2007.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Nauman. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Nauman. Go back to the $415, if you would, for just a minute. It was across the board to all of the school districts that had referendums. If they didn't happen to have one, there was no relief. If they had way more, they got some relief, but not all of it. But was it a continuing reduction so that we were assuming responsibility? And if it were a five-year debt, then it was 5 years. And if it were a 10-year, then it was 10 years?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, I think the way to think about this is that it was a permanent change. School districts are not allowed to make referendum authority for more than 10 years at any particular vote. So a school district... some school districts viewed this as a good deal because they didn't have to go out and ask for referendum authority at any point in the future for that $415 that they had on their allowance. The allowance change, assuming no legislative change to reduce the formula allowance, is permanent.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
So I'm looking at a school district's levy, and it had a referendum of up to $1,000 that they were charging. Rough numbers, and you reduced it by $415. If there were 8 years left, you would keep working on the $415 even beyond the 8 years. If that amount were reduced, you'd get an additional reduction. If it expired or were paid off, you'd pay off the next $415.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, I'm sorry, I misunderstood slightly what you were asking. The reduction occurs as of your authority at the point in time when it happens, and assuming that a school district is not bumping up into the cap on the referendum, they could go out and add additional authority. There was no prohibition for a school district to do that. But the formula allowance increase wasn't a permanent increase barring any legislative change.
Okay. Thank you.
Continue, Mr. Nauman.
So, Mr. Chairman, the second chart, I think, illustrates the buyout in terms of spending over time. The top bar, or I should say this is better in color. The triangles represents, I'm sorry, the diamonds represents the education spending from the 2002 fiscal year through the projections in 2009. The bottom line represents the education levy. So just looking at those two lines for the moment, you can see that in 2003, the diamonds took a big increase. That was a big spending increase that education budget experienced to begin paying for the general education levy, and the levies went down. Since that time, the levies have gradually progressed, and you notice, Mr. Chairman and members, that in the fiscal 2005, 2006 through 7 period, there was also some increases in education spending. Some of that is shift-induced. So we, in part to balance the K-12 budget over that time, we saved some money. We didn't spend quite as much as we should have at the time that the budget, should have is a value-laden word, and I don't mean it that way, but according to the formulas, we didn't spend the full formulas. Instead, we did some shifting between fiscal years, so that artificially depressed some of the spending in some of the early fiscal years. And then when we paid those back, there was an artificial increase. And what we've done with the diamond line is try to normalize for some of that. So if you adjust out the shift changes, you can see that the line is actually a little bit flatter.
So, Mr. Nauman, this triangle line is adjusted for the money that we borrowed from the schools and then paid back.
Mr. Chairman And you can see that in the 2003-2004 time period, the diamond is slightly higher than we actually spent because we had saved money in those fiscal years. And then in the 2005-2006 period when we were paying the shifts back, the diamonds are slightly higher than we were actually spending as the shifts were getting paid back.
And Mr. Nauman, I don't know if you're prepared to talk about this very much today, but at some point in the future, perhaps we will. Is part of this levy increase due to some of the equalizing formulas?
Mr. Chairman and members, if you're looking at the bottom line and
bottom
some of
line.
The increases, perhaps, yes, that is part of the answer. And I think the way I would characterize that would be that the equalizing factors have remained relatively static over the time period that we're looking at here. Property taxes and valuations, correction, property values have increased over this time period, and without adjustments in those formulas, the levy backfills the aid, and the aid comes down because school districts are looking wealthier. There's basically two ways the school district can get wealthy off the K-12 formulas. One is declining pupils, and the other is increasing property values. And we're having both on a statewide basis right now.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, I know you've got a lot of things on your agenda. You wanted me to specifically talk about the the language, and I'll get to that in a moment. One of the things that I provided you for informational purposes was the November forecasts for the general education program. This is gen ed only. Aid levy and total revenue for fiscal years 7 through 11. And I think that it might be useful to take a look at, you just take a look at the referendum, and that's line N. In fiscal year 2007, the levies were $484.1 million. That's the year that we're in right now. And the total revenue was $600. And then $107.6 million is in state aid. Now, of course, as we move forward, we're anticipating future growth. So this is not a perfect science, but you can, if you look at that line as you move forward, you can see that the aid levy splits do tend to see changes over time. It's just sort of informational purposes. And by the time you get to fiscal 11, the revenue's grown to 855, but the aid is $39.2 million.
And so, Mr. Nauman, without any changes, the aid is going to go down, the levy's going to go up, and the dollar amount is going up also?
Mr. Chairman and members, yes, based on projections.
Questions, members? Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, and members, that was just some background. At your pleasure, I'll move into the bill.
Sure.
I think the point of going through those first few charts will be clear when we begin talking through sections 1 through 4. Section 1 increases the basic formula allowance by an amount set in Section 4 of the bill. That amount is not determined as of the drafting of this bill, and there's a blank on line 3.26. But essentially, this is a 415 kind of transfer. So we will see a reduction in Section 2 of the referendum allowance, and the amount that the school district has in referendum would be reduced. And if the school district had no allowance, it would not go below zero. And that's what the operative lines 2.17 through 2.35 accomplish, the reduction on the referendum. And Mr. Chairman and members, Section 3 reduces the referendum allowance, cap, or the limit, by an amount that we also set in Section 4. So if the cap is, I think, about $1,294, and we were to take $294 in a transfer, the cap would come down to $1,000. It would be pulling it down. And I think the thinking, well, I'll let the office speak to Then on section 4, we actually set the amount that would be transferred.
Thank you, Mr. Nelman. Senator Bachman.
To the importance of bringing the cap down, Mr. Nelman, correct me if I'm wrong, but after the 2001 roll-in, I think we had a record number of excess levies run, and I think the argument was because the legislature bought down your excess levy by $415, you can vote for a new levy referendum and your property taxes won't go up. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chairman and members, in some cases, I apologize, Senator Bach and members, in some cases that would be the case. What we saw in 2001 was the cap was adjusted downwards equal to half the change. So we moved about 415 and we adjusted the cap about half of that, so roughly $200. And that was a compromise between the House and Senate positions. And so many districts saw a levy opportunity, in part because of the, I want to be clear, that part of that opportunity was as great as it was because of the general education buyout that was also occurring at the same time. But yes, many districts, I believe, sought referenda in the 2001 elections because they had this opportunity on the levy side.
And
Senator Bach,
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nelman, did a record number of them pass? I mean, more pass than we've seen in previous referendum elections?
Mr. Chairman and members,
Mr. Nelman,
I had some data before your committee last week that showed the numbers being substantially higher than normal. On a percentage basis, I'm not sure that it was the highest, but certainly in terms of raw numbers, districts actually seeking referenda, I think it was over 200 questions were put before the voters in that year, substantially higher than anything we've seen. We had only about, I think, 83 in this past election.
Thank you.
Senator Artman.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Nelman, could you go back to that fiscal year 2007 entitlement?
Sure.
One of your last points was that if you follow line N through all three charts, 07, 08, and 09, even up to 010 and 011, you see a decline in the aid and an increase in the levy. And I'm wondering, can you explain why the aid is going down?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ortman, yes. What we have in the referendum formula is a locked-in number, and there's two equalizing factors. One is 476,000 of referendum market value per pupil, and then there's a second tier at 270,000. It's a complicated way of saying that the legislature establishes the point at which we equalize. So if you are a school district with referendum market value above those numbers for either the first tier or the second tier, you receive no aid. But if you are a district with referendum market value below those numbers when we make the calculations, you will receive an aid levy mix, and the further below you are, you will receive more aid. As school districts' property values are increasing over time, they are coming off the formula. They are going above those numbers, and so their referendum then becomes raised all on levy. Of course, there are new districts coming online, so you can see the over time we're projecting that the total revenue is increasing, but the aid levy mix percentages are indeed changing over time. And I think it's interesting to note that just in anecdotally, in 2007, we had $600 million of referendum revenue and $107.6 million of aid. And then over time, when you get to fiscal year 2011, we're up to $855 million of revenue, but the aid has actually gone down to $39.2
million. Senator Artman.
Would there be some way for you to help us break out those aid numbers by the tiers at some other point? It might help us to understand. I'm not a school finance person, but it'd be good for us to know what those equalizing factors are doing to the whole scenario, and to break this down just a little bit further, I think would be helpful, because the school equalization formula should be part of our concern when we talk about property tax relief, because it's just going to keep happening unless we start looking at what the impact of that equalization is.
And Senator Artman, I think that we will have more discussion on the equalizing later on, but this is a jurisdiction of the K-12 committee, so we'll see what they do over there, and then when that bill comes through, probably the full committee will look at it. But yeah, I think you're right. I think we should look at this, and these formulas have not been adjusted since SWN 92-93.
Mr. Chairman and members, we added the second tier, I believe, in 2003. I'm not positive about that. Before, we had equalization just up to about $500 of referendum authority on the first tier. But that the equalizing factor that represents the current first tier, I don't think has been changed. I know we made technical adjustments to it in 2001, but to adjust for the tax base changes. But it's been a number of years since we've made any inflationary type adjustment.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, to your point, Senator Ortman, if the K-12 Finance Division decides to change that equalizing formula, that aid that gets spent will be in their budget. So I think that's, you know, hopefully levy would come down, which if they would send us a bill that actually reduced levy, that would be helpful to this committee. But the spending part, the aid part, is counted in the budget of the K-12 Division.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, I've stayed off that committee for that very reason. It's a complicated way of finance, but I think it's got implications for what we do in the tax committee because we have to follow up on what they do. There are consequences for the decisions that they make, and that leaves us in a tough position for long-term planning for tax purposes. And so I spoke with Senator Senator Score a little while ago thinking that it might be a good idea to have a joint meeting between the tax committee and the K-12 about this equalization factor, because it certainly has a disparate impact across the state, and yet it's something we look at as an overall factor and we're trying to adjust for it. And so I think it makes some sense to have some dialogue, and I appreciate Senator Skoy having Mr. Nauman in to help us with this. I find that we are reactive instead of planning ahead about how can we adjust the whole picture and make it something that creates more stability in the tax structure. And to have that conversation, I think we just have to keep working on the relationship between the tax committee and this equalization.
Well,
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, we've actually started that discussion. I had breakfast last week, Senator Skoy and I did, with Senator Stump and Senator Nauman, and he's a wonderful resource. And that's why the K-12 bill has to come to this committee, because they are very closely linked. Education funding is very much linked to state tax policy. And the reason that we haven't done much is the last 4 years we haven't had any money, and it costs money to reduce the reliance on property taxes for schools, because if we're going to put more aid in, it just costs dollars. And hopefully this year we'll be able to accomplish some of that.
I think Senator Bach and Senator Ortman, the last couple or number of years, the K-12 division has actually had a zero levy target, and we have put some state dollars into it in the Senate. I think that in the final, what has finally occurred, you know, we didn't prevail in some of those areas, and so the levies did go up. But I think we should continue that of trying to increase the aids and keep those levies flat as much as we can. Anything else, Mr. Nolan?
Mr. Chairman, only that the K-12 bill reduced $60 million of levy last year when we came through this committee.
$60 million of levy reduction?
We had a negative target last year of $60 million.
Thank you, Mr. Nolan.
I apologize for being late, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Mr. Nolan, being reminded, when you were in the full committee last week, I just want to remind the members about the total levy for education that we've had. It's $1.8 billion, and then we bought down that $1 billion. Could you just refresh our memories as to what those totals are and when we will go back above the levy amount that we had in 01-02?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I think you're looking at the property tax levy tracking for the November forecast. Is that in your packet?
Yes, it is in the packet. It's this
Mr. Chairman
sheet.
And members, the general education levy prior to the buy-down in fiscal year 2003 was the first year that it became effective. I'm looking at line 2. It was a general education levy of 1.3 in fiscal year 2002, and you see that that number went down to zero. And I will call your attention back to line 14 in just a moment. For the purposes, I think, of your question, if you flip to the very last page, on line 157.
Actually, the second page in the packet, I think.
Okay. On line 157, the total certified levies post-credits for the E-12 jurisdiction was $1.933 billion prior to the buyout, and it goes down to $986 million immediately after. And you can see that it has poked back up. And we crossed the line of 1.933 in taxes payable 2009, which is fiscal 10, based on these projections. But it's close enough that any little movement here or there, if we're off on the referendum projections, it actually could be taxes payable 2008. We'll have new data for you at the February forecast time period. And in last week's committee meeting, I called your attention to line 14 as the referendum. We were at $364.4 million of referendum revenue, or levy correction, in taxes payable 2001 fiscal 02. You can see it dropped to 226.3. That's the 415 buyout primarily, although some of that was, there was some new authority that came online at that point as well. And the projections now have the referendum levies in fiscal year 11 at $817.8 million. Based on the November forecast.
And Mr. Nauman, that's the line N that you were talking about earlier on the.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, pages. If I've done things correctly, they should correlate.
They do.
Not entirely.
Questions, members? Thank you, Mr. Nauman. Well, Mr. Paulson, back to where we were a few minutes ago. Thanks, sir.
Mr. Chairman, moving on in the bill then to page 3, section 5, is the first of the more strictly property tax credits. That is the residential homestead market value credit, and I'll try to give some background. It was enacted in 2001 with the class rate restructuring and so forth at that time. I did put I believe there's a chart in the packets that just show, it's a graph of how the market value credit works. Basically, it's just 0.4% of the market value of a homestead up to $76,000. At $76,000, it becomes 0.4% of $76,000 is $304. So that's the maximum credit. At that point, it begins to phase out between $76,000 and $414,000 at the rate of 0.09%. So it's a long phase out that goes with the credit. As far as why $76,000 and the phase out and so forth, I believe members also have in their packets recent trends in property taxes that Mr. Folkman handed out on the 17th. And I would direct your attention to page 6 of the property classification rates. If you look at the very top line there for residential homestead, it's a little hard to read on my copy, but less than 76,000 was 1% in 2001. Over 76,000 was 1.65%. So And if you look across from 2001 to 2006, the 1% stays the same. There was no class rate compression for the low tier of homestead value. On the other hand, over 76,000, the class rate drops from 1.65 down to 1, pretty significant class rate reduction. Between 76 and 500,000, and over 500,000, it's from 1.65 down to 1.25. So the value of homesteads over $76,000 was getting pretty significant relief under the class rate compression. But under 76,000, it was the same. Mr. Folkman talks about the shift onto homesteads that occurred through some of the class rate compression. And the market value credit was a way to mitigate the shift, particularly on the homes under 76,000, where there was no class rate compression. It phases out. One reason for a phase out is that homes at higher levels were already receiving the benefit of the class rate reduction, and there was not as much need because they weren't bearing as much of the shift at that time. So that's kind of the historical background. What has happened, of course, since that time is pretty rapid growth in market value of homesteads. And so what we see happening is that as homesteads increase in market value from one year to the next, not only are they most likely experience a higher tax from that basis, but also the credit is phasing out, so they receive less credit. That's an issue that for the committee to consider, I guess. And that's why it's in here. The various options for dealing with the credit would be to change that $76,000 to some higher amount, which apparently the governor's budget is considering, or changing the phase out to phase out more slowly. There are over 1 million homesteads, so it is a significant cost to do that. But that's kind of the background of Section 5.
And members, the reason, one of the reasons that we're looking at this graph is, as Mr. Paulson mentioned, if we are to put some resources into this area of the property tax, we could redraw this triangle in any number of different configurations to offer property tax relief. We could extend the 76,000 upward. We could extend it out over the phase out. Any number of differing redraws of that program. So that's why we've got this graph, and that's what I'd like you to be thinking about as we are discussing the homestead credit through the committee time. Mr. Paulson.
Mr. Chairman, moving on then to Section 6, that's the agricultural homestead market value credit. That's a credit on agricultural land. And much as with the residential homestead credit, there was a concern about potential for shifting of the tax onto agricultural land. When it was first enacted, the agricultural credit was 0.2% of market value of the first and then in the next year, the following year, there was a concern that there was too much of a burden being shifted onto agricultural land, and the credit was increased to 0.3% of the first $115,000. So the maximum credit then was $345, 0.3% of $115,000. And then it phases out at the rate of 0.05%, but it only phases back down to the 0.2% of value. It never goes to zero. So it's a little different situation with the agricultural credit, but they have generally been considered together, and so I thought it was we should look at it in the context of other things that the committee is doing. One other change as far as agricultural land is that the 2005, I believe. We indexed the first tier. The first tier of Ag Homestead land, 0.55%, is at $600,000, and that's going to $690,000 for taxes payable in 07, and I believe it's going to go to $790,000 for taxes payable in 08. So there are some things already built in for Ag Homesteads, and it's just a question of how where the committee wants to go with that.
And, Mr. Paulson, as you said, these have normally been considered together, but the same redraw of this chart would apply as we're putting more resources in. We can change the criteria to make that any way that we would choose. And in the Ag Homestead credit, while we don't have a graph like this, there is the phase out does not go to zero. It goes to $230,
Mr. Chairman. $230. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Questions? Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chairman, then moving on to Section 7, the property tax refund. This is the section that's the property tax refund for homeowners. The renter schedule is not in this bill. Again, referring to Mr. Folkman's chart, he has the number of filers on page. Page 16, number of homestead filers is projected to be 300,000 for fiscal year 2006. Again, there's a number of different parameters to this property tax refund. The percent paid by claimant is one option that is income sensitive. The committee could look at reducing the percent paid by claimant at the lower income levels. That would be one option. Another possibility would be to raise the maximum state refund. I believe that, I'm not sure if it was in Mr. Folkman's tables or not, I believe about 10% of the filers currently hit the maximum refund, so that their tax as a percent of their income is greater than the threshold in the law, but they simply get limited. They can't get enough refund to really bring them down to the percent of income that's specified.
And Mr. Paulson, have you had a chance to look at what the governor's proposal is, or are we going to talk about that tomorrow in full committee with regard to the property tax refund?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that will be discussed tomorrow. I do have some information here. I believe what they're doing is increasing the maximum. The governor's proposal would increase the maximum refund by 25% for taxpayers' income of 0 to 10,000, 20%, 10 to 20,000, 15%, 20 to 40, and 10% for incomes more than 40,000. So the maximum refund would go from $1,750 to $2,190. But I haven't spent a lot of time on this, Mr. Chairman. This is the information that's available.
And we'll take a look at that tomorrow in full committee. Any questions, members?
Moving on then, okay. Mr. Chairman. Section 8. Deals with the commonly referred to as the targeting refund. It's allowed in a situation where a taxpayer's homesteads goes up by more than 12% over the prior year. If the amount is over 100%, is over $100, they can get a refund of up to 60% of the excess over 12%. And this, again, is something for the committee to consider. It's one more way to provide property tax relief.
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Paulson, do you know how many filers currently are participating in the targeted refund program?
Mr. Chairman, this is again according to Mr. Folkman's tables here. Targeting for fiscal 2006, he has 75,000. It fluctuates pretty significantly. It's on page 16. Fiscal 2003, 15,000, 04, 160,000. Depends a lot on what's going on in the property tax system as a whole. It may be related to some extent with passage of referenda by schools, but there is a pretty significant fluctuation in the number of claimants.
And so, Mr. Paulson, what you're telling us, if we're successful in our efforts to kind of hold down property taxes, this number would come down.
Mr. Chairman, I would expect that targeting to be less of an issue if we're successful in other aspects of property tax relief, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Artman.
Are there any other limits to the qualification for the program? Is it just a function of how much your property taxes went up?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Basically, it's just for taxes payable on a homestead more than 12%, more than $100.
Senator
Artman.
No limit or requirement as to income or age or anything like that. No limit whatsoever. So you could have a $2 million home and you can earn $1 million in income every year, and you could still qualify for this as long as your 12%, your property taxes went up by 12%.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator Ortman, that's true. The maximum refund is $1,000, but it is not income sensitive like the property tax refund.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Section 8 is just adjusting the property tax refund brackets for inflation. Anytime we make a change in the schedule, we need to update what's in the law for the inflation to bring it up to current law. Then, Mr. Chairman, on page 7, Section 10 brings us to the subject of local government aid. There'll be three different sections dealing with local government aid. The first section, Mr. Chairman, has to do with revenue need for cities. I guess, briefly, Mr. Chairman, the local government aid formula is basically, it's an attempt to measure the needs of cities for local funding based on the results of a formula that's actually a regression analysis. You can see the regression here for certain need factors. Some of those factors, like the pre-1940 housing percentage, go back to the 2000 census. And one of the things that has been done in the past with the local government aid need factor is to adjust it for inflation. In 2003, when the local government aid formula was rewritten, the need factor was adjusted, but it was adjusted in such a way that inflation on the need factor didn't kick in until aid's payable in 2006. So there was a lag because it's an annual average for 2003, implicit price deflator. And at least a couple of different times in the Senate tax bill, we have proposed bringing that implicit price deflator back to 2001, 2002, basically to give additional inflation on the need factors. The effect is most pronounced on those cities where the gap between needs and expenditures is narrower. For a regional center or first class city, the gap between needs and expenditures tends to be need and revenue raising capacity. Tends to be relatively wide. This has less of an effect on them than it does on, say, an inner ring suburb, where the gap between need and revenue-raising capacity is relatively narrow. So it tends to be the benefit of those types of cities, inner ring suburbs. And it's something that the Senate has carried at least a couple different times in the past. Mr. Chairman, moving on then to Section 11 is another topic that has been in the Senate tax bill. That is the, in 2003, the taconite aids for cities on the Iron Range were made part of the revenue-raising capacity for cities, and it had the effect of reducing aid for those cities. In 2005, I believe, we took out seven cities that were directly impacted by taconite mines, and this language would strike the remaining of the remainder of the Iron Range cities from the revenue-raising capacity for the local government aid formula. Moving on then, Mr. Chairman, to Section 12. This is basically just the appropriation section, and to the extent that the committee wants to go in the direction of increasing the appropriation for local government aid, this is the section that we would amend. Currently, you can see the appropriation for 2007 at $485 million. And to what point the committee's budget allows an increase in that, I guess we'll have to evaluate with other priorities. Moving on then, Mr. Chairman, to Section 13. That is county program aid. Again, Mr. Chairman, a bit of history. In 2003, the county aids for Homestead Agricultural Credit Aid, or HACA, County Criminal Justice Aid, Family Preservation Aid, were brought together under a single program called County Program Aid. It's really split into two parts. Between what's referred to as need aid, that's the $100,500,000 that's struck there. So that's one place that we could increase the appropriation for counties for things like the county share of Part 1 crimes statewide. There's a provision for percentage of elderly and percentage receiving food stamps. Those are three different parts of the need aid. And then the in paragraph B, the limit is $105 million for what's referred to as tax-based equalization aid. And that really is a an attempt to replace HACA, I guess you could say, where giving more aid to counties with a lower tax base.
Mr. Paulson, members, we have a handout dealing with county program aid that gives a little more detail of what Mr. Paulson's talking about. I apologize for not getting it to you quicker, but it will be helpful in, when you're reviewing these aid splits. And it's the landscape table, Minnesota Revenue County Tax Base Equalization Aid.
Thank you.
And the County Need Aid. Mr. Paulson, do you have these so that you are can guide the committee through where you're at when you're talking about the county program aid?
Mr. Chairman, I may have two copies of the same thing here, I'm afraid.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, looking first at the one that's titled County Tax Base Equalization Aid 2007, it begins in column one with the adjusted net tax capacity for each county. That's adjusted for sales ratio. And then 9.45% of that is column two. I'm not sure exactly how to characterize these entirely. What ends up happening, the preliminary factor is $185 per capita in column five from that is subtracted 9.45% of the adjusted net tax capacity, which gives you a preliminary factor. The population factor is adjusted for different categories of population. You might look and notice that Hennepin County is a 0.25. Some of the smaller counties, like Clearwater County, are at 3. And then the adjusted, or the unadjusted, I'm sorry, tax base equalization aid is the preliminary tax base equalization factor times the population factor. That's allocated down to reach the appropriation cap of $105 million.
And Mr. Paulson, what remembers mostly what we're looking at on this chart is these counties are taking their tax capacity and dividing their population into it, and I'd draw you to a couple of counties, Cass and Cook, and what happens when you have a low population base and a relatively increasing valuations, you fall off the formula, and so even if we are putting money into it in these current scenarios, it wouldn't go any of the resources to those counties. Now these two counties are at zero, but there's a number of smaller rural counties with a flat or reducing population, and it is this part of the formula is probably not accurately reflecting the need that we have in some of those areas. Senator Bach?
Well, Mr. Chairman, when you hear from cabin owners complaining about their property taxes, this is what's going on, because aid in Cook County, about 60% of their tax capacity is seasonal rec, and so cabin owners are carrying a large part of the burden. The state really isn't well, you can see here in this case, it's not participating at all, so the burden is being carried by the property owners as that seasonal rec property goes up in value, and I don't represent Cass County, but I'm sure it's the same situation there with Leech Lake and the other lakes in that Walker area. Cabin owners aren't wrong. They're carrying a big burden because there's no state aid for the county portion.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Moving to the other handout entitled County Need Aid 2007. There are, as a reminder, the tax base equalization aid, the total is $105 million. For county need aid, that's $100 million. So it's a little less than the tax base equalization aid, a little less than half of the total program. There are three factors within county need aid, and basically for each of those, it's a proportion of the total. It's just a percent share, essentially. For the percent share of age-adjusted population, it's a $40 million appropriation, and for each county, it's an adjustment to the population for based on the presence of elderly within the county. And then for the next columns, three and four, have to do with the three-year average of the number receiving food stamps within the county. Again, it's a $40 million appropriation for that factor, and it's allocated on a percentage basis by county. And finally, the three-year average Part 1 crimes relates back to the county criminal justice aid. That's a $20 million appropriation. And, again, it's based on the percentage by county. Those add up to the total county need aids that you see in the gray column there.
And, Mr. Paulson, could you give us just a real short history of how this formula came about and what time it did? We used to have a large number of county grant programs and aid programs, and they were all rolled together. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Mr. Chairman, yes. County program aid is a combination of HACA for counties in that in 2003. Was $194 million approximately. County criminal justice aid in 2003, $32.5 million, and family preservation aid in 2003 that was about $24 million. So those aids together became part of county preservation aid. In 2003, the governor recommended restructuring both county and city aid formulas, and I believe in the governor's bill that was proposed, there was a requirement that, or there was an incentive, I guess, that city aids will be $250 million unless there is a formula that the governor approves of, then there would be significant additional aid. So there were a number of discussions at the staff level and so forth about principles, and in the end, the revised local government aid formula and the revised county program aid formula were enacted.
So, Mr. Paulson, all of this came out in 2003, and has anybody taken much of a look at whether this Part 1 crimes, for example, is an accurate reflection of what some of the criminal justice costs are?
Mr. Chairman, I think it would bear revisiting. I don't think there's been a lot of staff time or study paid to that particular factor in the formula. In 2001, there was also something that was for out-of-home placement. It was in law for a couple of years. That was dropped in 2003. There were some issues with the way that the data and how the program might have worked. But there has been some interest on the part of counties and the legislature to look at other aspects of criminal justice or out-of-home placement, those sorts of programs for counties.
Thank you, Mr. Paulson. And members, when we will have the county folks in the committee in the next coming weeks, and this is part of the area that I'd like to focus in on if we can. And then I think we're getting to the end of the bill, Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chairman, we have reached the end of the bill.
And so could you give us just a minute or two of what about the expiration of the market value levy caps or whatever that terminology is that I keep forgetting?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Limited market value. It's chart 9, I believe.
That would be chart 9 in Mr. Folkman's handout?
Yes, it's from Mr. Folkman's, and it's on page 11, members. And when Mr. Folkman was in the full committee, we were talking about what, actually you can see my little scribbles there, what's going to happen when that percentage goes off the chart down to zero in the coming years, and what year does it go to zero, and
um, Yes, Mr. Chairman, also as part of the 2001 tax bill, the limited market value began to be phased out over a period of years. The phase-out was extended by 2 years in 2005. The way that the limit works is that the increase on the properties that qualify for limited market value cannot be more than 15% from 1 year to the next, except that if it's more than 25%, it can go up by 25% of the difference. Is in place for assessment years 2005, 2006. So for taxes payable in 2007, we're still under the 15% and 25% limits. Next year for taxes payable in 2008, the 15% and then the percent of difference goes to 33%. Again, stays at 15% on the limit, but it goes to 50% on the percent of the difference for assessment year 2008, payable 2009, and after taxes payable 2009, limited market value is gone. I would recommend to the committee this limited market value report that the department puts out. It'll be coming out again March 1st. This is the last one for payable 2006. There's a lot of data in here by city and township, the history of limited market value, and one of the things we looked at this a little bit last year, for homesteads we've had very substantial market value growth for a period of years now, the last few years, that appears to be tapering off, and so it may be, as limited market value phases out, it may be less of an issue for the homesteads than it is for possibly the seasonal properties and the agricultural land, which is still seeing pretty substantial market value growth. And so for those, I think what we're going to see is that for homes, the amount under the limit is decreasing year by year because of the phase-out. But for ag property and farms, I think we're going to see again that the amount under the limit is still going up. So that's something, I guess the data is available, the study is not published yet. I could look into that sooner if necessary. There may be different impacts for seasonal and ag land than there are for residential homesteads, possibly.
And Mr. Paulson, as you know, if we don't extend this and this really does expire, it would be incumbent upon us to make sure that the valuations that are increasing and being limited are actually, you know, reflected to what's going on in that classification. And I'm particularly thinking about the ag land and some of the work that I'm considering doing there. Is there a sales issue or a classification rate issue with seasonal rec like there might be in agriculture, or is that not accurate?
I'm not sure I understand, Mr. Chairman.
Well, what I'm thinking is some of the ag values are, you know, being driven by sales that are in that classification but not tied to agriculture. But seasonal rec, would there be something that would be a comparable thought there?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of an issue where seasonal properties are being bought for their investment value, but I guess that is a possibility to consider. There is, I think, more of an issue in agricultural properties with some agricultural land being converted to recreational use and also to just as an investment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Paulson. Questions? Senator Bach.
Kind of to that point, Mr. Chairman, as you think about ag land, timberland is experiencing the same problem, is that it seems like the higher and better use these days is strong demand by the outdoors community for hunting land and ultimately become seasonal rec instead of timberland, and market values are going up significantly on timberland, which is driving the fragmentation issue, is more and more timberland gets buildings on it, it's get harder and harder to manage the land for timber. So I'd like you to consider, I think we should consider some kind of a classification change so that there's not this tax pressure driving the fragmentation in our timberland base erodes further.
Well, thank you, Jack. I think we've finished with the presentation for today. Members, there will be a number of thoughts outside of Senate File 1 that we'll be thinking at. We're going to look at some of the small city stuff. I think we need to explore the equalizing at schools. I think it would be incumbent on us to try to understand these formulas as much as we can so that when we're looking at putting money in, we make sure it's going where we want it to go and achieving the goal that we want. We're going to have the next couple of meetings next week and the following week, I think, would have the cities and the counties are coming in, townships are going to be in here, suburban city group. And then, also, we're going to have the county assessors come in and talk about some of the studies that the department has been done. They've done a woodlands, rural lands study, and see what if there's something that we should be doing with regard to some of that stuff. Then after those couple of meetings, we'll see what bills we have, and if you guys have any issues, I'd like to hear about them and see if it's something that we should look at in these first two or three weeks and before we start hearing bills. Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, and also to Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, I think this is a good start at property taxes, the major issues, but there are so many things that feed into the property taxes. And one of the things I'm interested in, not simply because of Carver County, but I'm very interested in the sales tax for construction materials and things like that across the state. We charge cities and counties sales tax at the state of Minnesota, and maybe that doesn't make a lot of sense. They come in, they ask for exemptions. There are certain things that we grant them exemptions for, certain things that we don't grant exemptions, and you've got the specter of counties and cities that are bonding and paying interest on sales tax because they're dealing with infrastructure needs and growth, which is not really a factor in any of the things we talk about in our aid, but the growth needs and infrastructure needs are have a big impact on what they do locally, and that sales tax is at least something we should consider. Instead of sending out all these aids, maybe we shouldn't ask them to be paying in so much. And so I'm hoping that we can look at that as a function of maybe not this bill, but of the conversation in its entirety.
Well, yeah, Mr. Senator Chairman, I'm sure there's people in this room that remember. Mr. Reed probably remembers, but I think the legislative history on local governments paying sales tax, as I remember it, is in the early 80s when the state was facing a budget deficit, a decision had to be made, and local units of government were giving given the option of either having their aid cut or to pay state sales tax. And my understanding is the local governments chose to pay the state sales tax rather than have their aids cut. Now, I guess I'll ask staff to kind of reaffirm that for us, but I believe that's how we got where we are. And I just kind of would caution people. I think the emphasis of the tax committee is going to be to provide property tax relief for people, and there probably isn't going to be a lot of money in our bill to provide tax expenditures, to do kind of nice things that people want, but I think the major focus is going to be on spending our budget target on doing something about escalating property taxes. But we're certainly going to have some money for tax expenditures. I'll see how much Senator Cohen and I are going to start meeting this week. I'll see how much I can arm wrestle away from him for us to spend. But I think our emphasis needs to be on doing something about escalating property taxes, because I do think that's what I hear from the public, at least.
And Senator Ortman, I think we, when we do have resources, we have tried to move back. I think we did gravel and construction equipment, our sales tax exempt now. So I think that, it would be good if we could move back, but it is also a question of resources.
Well, and Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I don't think that you should look at them as separate, because the if the counties and the cities are paying sales tax, then it is a function of property taxes. They are extending that out to the property tax owners. And I've never really thought of it as a tax expenditure, not to charge so much in taxes. I don't think it's an expenditure. We just don't take in as much income. And so I would hope that you would look at that sales tax factor as part of how much, the overall picture of how much aid should we be giving cities. Maybe we don't have to give them as much aid to reflect the fact that we are not charging them sales tax for their expenditures or the counties. And so pull that maybe in as one of the contributing factors to the amounts that we authorize for LGA and other aids.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Buck.
I certainly would welcome the discussion with local units of government if they would be willing to have their aid reduced and the state not collect the sales tax. I think that's kind of a wash, but it is true when the tax committee spends money on tax expenditures, it is just like a finance committee handing money out. It's just the way money gets counted around here. If we don't collect it, it's like we spent it in this committee. So,
anything else, members? Thank you. We will be meeting next Tuesday, same time. Committee's adjourned.